basta ya de la ilusión de que los problemas del mundo se pueden resolver con armas nucleares. Las bombas
pensaban seguir,
podrán matar a los hambrientos,
el 100% con casas de apartamentos y echar al
a los ignorantes. Pero no pueden matar el hambre, las enfermedades, la ignorancia.
Para seguirlo explotando.
No pueden tampoco matar la justa rebeldía de los pueblos.
Hello and welcome to the Lefty Leftist Podcast. This is part two of my dive into Cuba. If you haven't listened to part one, I really highly recommend checking it out first. It provides some critical background information regarding Cuba leading up to its revolution. If you don't want that info, well, what can I do? Again, this episode is a bit longer than usual, albeit most likely shorter than my last. Anyways, this may be a reoccurring theme in my podcast, but please, again, feel free to listen to this episode in chunks if you aren't the type of person who can sit through a long lecture. And trust me, I know there's lots of you out there, myself included. Anyways, without further ado, Cuba, Part 2, Electric Boogaloo. I'm sorry. The Cuban Revolution. Now, as I said at the end of my last episode, today's story won't start with the voyage of the Granma. Instead, it will start 16 years before that fateful voyage. Today's story begins with a young mestizo man about to take over a country which seems to always be recovering from civil strife. Today's story begins on October 10th, 1940, with Fulgencio Batista, the dashing reformist supported by socialists, communists, and workers' unions alike, ascending to the presidency of Cuba. Now, Batista, for the time being, was exactly what Cuba needed. At only 39 years old at the time of his election, the young Batista showed a lot of promise at the beginning. Like I said a few seconds ago, he was supported by Cuba's upstart left, and Batista returned the support with sweeping social and economic reforms. Batista put into place labor laws which favored unions and openly condemned all forms of fascism. This, of course, was the fashion in the world at the time. In fact, the early 1940s probably saw the friendliest relations between the Western capitalist systems and the communist systems. This was mainly due to Hitler and his Nazis wreaking havoc all across the world. Now, Batista's Cuba entered World War II 2 days after the attack on Pearl Harbor. Batista also was a supporter of an invasion of fascist Spain. However, no such war, of course, came to pass. And that's where Batista's first reign ends. Yes, I see. Pretty good. Like, good old Batista, you know, doing his normal thing, basically being a pretty average, actually slightly above average, because again, he was a huge supporter of unions, labor agreements. He assisted and basically created more favorable conditions for Cuba's large, large labor and peasant or campesino population. But you see, Batista is going to come back later on today's story, and he is going to come back with a vengeance. In the meantime, let's skip to 1944. Now, Batista had a hand-picked successor to carry on his reforms in Cuba, but this successor lost to none other than Ramon Grau. Now, if you don't know who Ramon Grau is, I suggest you listen to my previous episode, like I said at the beginning, because it provides some key context for you. But Ramon Grau won the election in 1944. This, of course, sent Batista into a tantrum. He tried to undermine this new Grau regime by calling in the aid of the United States. In a July 17, 1944 dispatch to the U.S. Secretary of State, the U.S. Ambassador Sproul Braden wrote, and I quote, "It is becoming increasingly obvious that the President Batista intends to discomfit the incoming administration in every way possible, particularly financially. A systematic raid of the Treasury is in full swing, with the result that Dr. Grau will probably find empty coffers when he takes office on October 10th. it is blatant that President Batista desires that Dr. Grau San Martin should assume obligations which in fairness and equity should be a matter of settlement by the present administration. End quote. Not long after Grau took power, Batista divorced his wife, moved to the U.S., married a new woman, and started anew. This is where he would stay for the next 8 years. Now, Grau's term after Batista wasn't that remarkable. The only thing of note I could find was that Grau's Cuba was the only Western country to vote against the creation of Israel. Now, Grau's rule ended without much in terms of legacy in 1948. He was then replaced by Carlos Prio. Now, Prio was the last, shall we say, run-of-the-mill Cuban leader. And by that, I mean a president who is not really remembered today. However, Prio thought highly of himself, and after his term ended, he famously said this quote, quote, "They say I was a terrible president of Cuba. That may be true, but I was the best president Cuba ever had." End quote. And if that quote doesn't say something about the remainder of today's story and how Cuba thought of his presidents since then, well, I don't know what will. Anyways, Prio, known as El Presidente Cordial, or the Cordial President, was committed to a rule marked by civility, primarily in its respect for freedom of expression. Several public works projects and the establishment of a national bank and tribunal of accounts are counted among his, innumerous successes. However, violence among political factions and reports of theft and self-enrichment in the government, ranks marred Prio's term. The Prio administration increasingly came to be perceived by the government as ineffectual in the face of violence and corruption, much as the Grau administration before it. So you can see tensions are starting to build here. By the way, if you couldn't tell, I'm actually reading off a script, and I'm pretty bad at reading off scripts. So I always sort of deviate, and sometimes my reading voice isn't the greatest. So, I mean, if you've gotten this far in the episode, I appreciate it. But just be prepared for some slight errors, some slight syntax mistakes. Not syntax, what's that term? Anyways, you get it. So, Prio, 1940, what is this, 8? He's, sort of suffering a little bit because he's a bit of a bad reputation among Cuba's political ruling class. Now, if there's anything that Prio's administration is known for, it's how it ended. See, during the 1952 election, an even more ambitious Batista made a triumphant return and threw his name on the ballot. However, very quickly, Batista realized that he did not have much confidence that he would win this election. So, what does Batista do? He staged a coup for the second time in his career. This coup also began at the Columbia Barracks, not far from Havana. The excuse made public was that the current regime was planning to remain in power whatever the election result was. Batista later proudly pointed out that the coup had taken altogether precisely 1 hour and 17 minutes. In the early hours of the morning, young officers shut their generals in their quarters and assumed command of 4 infantry battalions at the camp. At 2:40 in the morning, they took control of all major strategic points in Havana, including government ministries, the airport, railway and bus stations, electricity plants, the radio station, and the telephone exchange. Armored cars led truckloads of troops to attack the presidential palace in the center of the city. There was little resistance, and after 2 guards had been killed and a few people wounded, the palace hung white sheets out of the window as a surrender signal. The defeated president and other members of the administration had taken refuge in the Mexican embassy. They were allowed to fly out to Mexico, and Batista canceled the election and installed himself as dictator. The regime he replaced had been both weak and corrupt and was not widely regretted. Batista was now in the driver's seat once again. See, under Prio, Cuba's economy was stagnant due to the fluctuations in the prices of sugar on the world market. This was Batista's priority now that he assumed power again. The second Batista regime began much like the first. He sought out a better Cuba for the Cuban people. But of course, this would not last. Batista's term in the 1950s was marked by a few major blemishes. And let me say major, I mean major. blemishes. The first being the open corruption within the government and upper crust of Cuban society. See, Batista saw the major potential for American tourism in Cuba and promoted new resorts, bars, hotels, and most importantly, casinos. Cuba was easy access and cheap for American residents living in Florida and New York City. Therefore, this new tourism boost was successful. Now, these casinos began to become much too seedy for Batista's liking. To resolve this, the Cuban government called in the long time, American gangster Meyer Lansky. Lansky, he's a tough name to pronounce. But if you're not too familiar with Meyer Lansky, I'm sure you can find a true crime podcast that talks about him, because I think he even made a cameo, or a character playing him made a cameo. I forget the name of the movie series now, but it'll come to me maybe at 2 o'clock in the morning. But you can Google him. He's very, very popular. Very, very famous gangster. Anyways, Batista called him in to come and clean up the casinos of Cuba. Most of the casinos in Cuba were handed over to Lansky, and those casinos subsequently became the most successful ones in Cuba. Tourism was booming, and so was the Cuban economy. But this boom was not shared amongst all Cubans. Something was going on in Cuba in the early 1950s. Something which largely flew under the radar until it became too big to ignore. See, while Batista focused on tourism, Cuba's communists grew more and more discontented with the influx of foreign money and gentrification of Cuba's urban centers. To get the full picture, we need to step back a few years to 1947, where we will introduce Fidel Alejandro Castro Ruz, or just Fidel Castro for simplicity, the main protagonist of today's story. Now, I will not go into Fidel's personal life and history. Instead, I will introduce him as a 21-year-old on the brink of leading a people's revolution. If you want to learn more about Fidel, I highly, highly recommend reading My Life, his autobiography. Anyways, 1947 was Fidel's first brush with organized Marxist revolutionary activity. It was in that year when he learned about a planned revolution to overthrow the fascist dictator in the Dominican Republic, Rafael Trujillo, who was basically an American puppet at that point. All of this, by the way, was happening in the early days of the Cold War, where the unfounded fear of communism was sweeping the Western world. Anyways, back to Fidel. Now, Fidel, being Fidel, joined this expedition to the DR with a force of over just 1,000 Cuban Marxists and Dominicans in exile. This insurrection, however, didn't even get off the ground, as Grau, remember him from earlier, stopped it under the pressure of the United States. This, however, was the first revolutionary act in what would be Fidel's revolutionary life. Returned to Havana, Fidel played a leading role in many student protests and was brutally beaten up by the police in 1948. At this time, his speeches became more and more leftist, and it became clear what his views were. Now, Fidel also participated in leftist activities in Colombia in 1948. In the following years, Fidel's prominence rose as he put himself at the forefront of issues which plagued the working-class Cubans, such as increased bus fares. All the while, the young Castro became more and more radical. Now, at this time, keep in mind, Fidel never actually came out as a socialist until much later, but I'll talk about that in a bit. In 1950, Fidel, a recent graduate of a PhD in law, co-founded a legal firm which aimed to protect poor Cubans. This, however, was unsustainable in Prio's capitalist Cuba. This didn't discourage Fidel, however, as he continued to push the revolutionary cause in any way possible. He continued to participate in student protests and making public speeches. In 1952, Fidel wanted to run for Congress, but senior Cuban government officials blocked this attempt and refused to nominate him as a candidate. Instead, he was nominated as a candidate in Cuba's House of Representatives, as it represents those in Havana's poorest districts. Okay, now we're caught up on Fidel. 1952 is where the main part of today's story begins. After all, most sources state that the Cuban Revolution officially began in 1952. So strap in, we're about to enter a time period where things get, well, let's just say, a bit more complicated, as if Cuba's history wasn't complicated enough already. Now, while Fidel was running for a seat in the House, he actually met with Batista, his would-be adversary. Batista even offered him a role in Batista's government if Batista won his election. Of course, Batista became impatient and staged a coup. Typical of him. Anyways, Fidel was unsuccessful in this election as well. Later on, in 1952, Batista began to suppress Cuba's left, causing Fidel and other Cuban leftists to bring legal charges against the Cuban government. However, these were all a resounding failure. Castro, along with his comrades, began seeking alternative ways, shall we say, to overthrow Batista. This new path soon formed into an organized revolutionary movement, simply known as the Movement, soon to become the 26th of July Movement. But I'll get into that in a bit. In 1952, the movement was a small group which published an illegal newspaper called El Acusador, or The Accuser. They also began arming its members and recruiting anti-Batista sympathizers all across Cuba. The vast majority of these recruits came from the poorer areas of Havana, the most victimized population under Batista's second regime. At this time, even though Fidel was definitely a socialist, he didn't actually form an alliance with the official Communist Party in Cuba. This was mainly done to keep a more moderate approach and to gain the interest of more moderate Cubans, which may be scared away if Fidel came out as a radical leftist. Now, Fidel, however, did keep in close contact with the Communist Party, which his brother Raúl was an active member of. As 1952 progressed into 1953, Fidel's movement stockpiled weapons in preparation for an attack on the Moncada barracks, just outside of Santiago de Cuba. The plan was to have the revolutionaries disguise themselves as regular soldiers by purchasing surplus uniforms, weapons, and ammunition. They also stole uniforms from the military hospital. The night before the attack, the men gathered at a farm in Siboney, where they learned what the objective was. The plan was to secure the barracks and gain possession of the weapons stored within, and to use the building's army communications equipment to spread false information and messages for several hours to confuse the military. In the meantime, the weapons will be removed and hidden throughout the city to use in the continuing struggle, and Santiago's radio station would be taken to broadcast the speeches of Eduardo Chivas, a staunch anti-Batista figure in Cuba at the time, in order to mobilize the public with the ultimate aim of bringing down the Batista government. Now, this was the plan. Now, one interesting fact to learn about Fidel's movement was that there was a strikingly low number of Afro-Cubans or even mixed Cubans involved. This was primarily due to many Afro-Cubans and Mestizo Cubans supporting Batista due to Batista's partial African heritage. This is not unique in the Western world, just so you know. Just look at how the black community reacted to Obama, Kamala Harris. Both, in my opinion, terrible politicians, but due to their racial heritage, managed to gather a lot of support from many people of color. Anyways, back to the Moncada barracks. The movement chose to attack the barracks on the 26th of July, hence the name the 26th of July Movement. This date was chosen because the 25th of July was a festival in Santiago de Cuba, and it was assumed that many of the soldiers would be drunk or hungover. Anyways, at 5 a.m. on the 26th, Fidel led the revolutionaries, roughly 150 in total, in an attack against the garrison in Moncada. The group formed 16 of the... Let me restart there. This is what happens when I read a script. I make mistakes. The group formed a 16-vehicle caravan in order to give the appearance of being a delegation headed by a highly ranking officer from Western Cuba. Their plan was that the first group of 20 men, led by Abel Santa Maria, would take a civilian hospital at the rear of the barracks. A second group of men, led by Lester Rodriguez, would take the Audiencia building. And a third group of 90 men, led by Fidel, would take the barracks, including the radio transmitter within it. The attack, however, did not go to plan. Right from the get-go, the caravan of vehicles became separated. By the time they arrived at the barracks, on top of that, the car carrying the bulk of the weapons got lost. It was just terrible luck. According to Fidel, in his autobiography, he drove his car into a group of soldiers at the gate of the barracks. Believing they were already inside the barracks, the men in the cars behind jumped out, resulting in the alarm being sounded before the revolutionaries even managed to infiltrate the actual barrack buildings. This resulted in the revolutionaries being outnumbered 10 to 1. In the end, this attack was a resounding failure. 15 soldiers and 3 policemen were killed in the attack. This was in contrast to 5 revolutionaries being killed, but 56 later being executed by the Batista regime. 18 more rebels were captured in the hospital and were executed on the spot in the target range of the barracks. Their corpses were then positioned around the barracks to make it seem like they died in combat. 34 additional revolutionaries were later captured and murdered without trial. A few revolutionaries, including Fidel, managed to escape into the nearby countryside, but were captured very, very soon after. Those revolutionaries who did not face the firing squad were imprisoned just north of Santiago de Cuba. Now, the Batista regime did not take Fidel that seriously. They actually believed that he was incapable of planning such an attack. Rather than persecute Fidel, the government charged members of the Communist Party, putting a total of 122 defendants on trial for the attack. Acting in his own defense, Castro cited the José Martí, remember him from the previous episode, as an intellectual author of the attack and convinced the 3 judges to overrule the army's decision to keep all of the defendants handcuffed in court, proceeding to argue that the charge of which they were accused of, quote, organizing an uprising of armed persons against the constitutional powers of the state, end quote, was incorrect, for they had risen up against Batista, who had seized power in an unconstitutional manner. The trial embarrassed the army and Batista by revealing that they had tortured suspects, after which they tried unsuccessfully to prevent Fidel from testifying any further, claiming he was too ill. The trial ended on the 5th of October with the acquittal of most defendants. 55 were sentenced to prison terms between 7 months and 13 years. Fidel was sentenced on the 16th of October, during which he delivered a speech that he would be printed under the title of History Will Absolve Me. Fidel was sentenced to 15 years imprisonment in the hospital wing of the Presidio Modelo, a relatively comfortable modern prison on the Isla de Pinos. His brother, Raúl, was sentenced to 13 years. However, in 1955, under broad political pressure, the Batista government freed all political prisoners in Cuba, including the attackers on the Moncada barracks. Fidel's childhood teacher succeeded in persuading Batista to include Fidel and Raúl in the release. Soon, the Castro brothers joined with other exiles in Mexico to prepare for the overthrow of Batista. And that's where I will end part one of today's episode. Although, you know, hope was seemingly lost for the revolutionaries, the revolution would not give up. Anyways, enjoy this brief interlude before we get back into probably the greatest revolution of the mid-20th century.
Ganando el 100% con casas de apartamentos y echar al pueblo a sufrir y seguir de modo cruel contra el pueblo conspirando para seguirlo explotando y en eso llegó Fidel. Y se acabó la diversión, llegó el comandante y mandó a parar. Y se acabó la
diversión. I hope you enjoyed that brief break, grabbed your coffee, spiked with the finest of Cuban rums, and settled in for part two. Before we get to Fidel and his revolutionaries in Mexico, let's divert briefly and introduce another protagonist of the Cuban Revolution, Ernesto Che Guevara. Now, Che was probably the most iconic figure of the revolution outside of Cuba, mainly due to the famous photo of him staring intensely off into the distance wearing his military-style beret. However, Che was much more than that to the Cuban Revolution. Now, I won't go into Che's background and personal life. If you would like to learn more about Che, I highly recommend watching the film The Motorcycle Diaries and reading Che Guevara, A Revolutionary Life by John Lee Anderson. For now, what you need to know is that Che was heavily involved in leftist revolutionary activity before he joined Fidel de Mexico, and he would continue his involvement in revolutionary activity until his execution in Bolivia in 1967. Che actually connected with Raúl Castro first, and then introduced Che to Fidel in 1955. During their first meeting, Che famously remarked how the cause of the Cuban people was what he was searching for, and he quickly joined the 26th July movement. Even though Che and Fidel could not be more different, Che, you know, filling that sort of Latin American hero role, and Fidel being much more revolutionary, both of them developed a friendship based on a commitment to anti-imperialism, anti-capitalism, and socialist revolution. Of course, it wasn't just Che and Fidel leading the revolution. Another lesser known outside of Cuba major figure played a key role, Camilo Cienfuegos Gurriarán. Now, Cienfuegos spent a considerable amount of time supporting the anti-Batista movements in Cuba at the time, mainly being involved in student-led movements in Havana. After leaving Cuba under the pressure of the police harassment, he arrived in Miami, then went to San Francisco. Shortly after, he went to Mexico to join Fidel and the other revolutionaries. Cienfuegos was among the less than 100 revolutionaries which would take that fateful voyage from Mexico to Cuba. Some other important figures of the movement were Juan Almeida Bosque and Frank País, who were also among the revolutionaries who attacked the Moncada barracks. There was also Celia Sanchez, who started by smuggling weapons for the revolution, later becoming a soldier herself, and the primary planner of the voyage of the Granma, which I will get into in a short while. All said and done, there were 82 revolutionaries in total. 82 revolutionaries who would lead a revolution which would have a global impact. Now, while the revolutionaries were planning for the attack, Cuba was sinking into a seemingly endless pit of corruption. Now, remember how I told you about Batista and his mafia ties? Well, they only got worse, because Batista encouraged large-scale gambling in Cuba, especially in Havana. In 1955, he announced that Cuba would grant a gaming license, or basically gambling license, to anyone who invested $1 million into a hotel or $200,000 into a new nightclub, and the government would provide matching public funds for construction, a 10-year tax exemption, and waive duties on imported equipment and furnishings for new hotels. This, of course, damaged the Cuban manufacturing business greatly, as well as construction businesses. Each casino would pay the government $250,000 for the license, plus a percentage of the profits. The policy basically forgot about background checks, as required for casinos in the United States, which opened the door for casino investors with illegally obtained funds. Bring in basically all the drug traffickers, all the big mafiosos, all of them laundering their money through Cuban casinos. It was a huge thing in the 50s. Anyways, Cuban contractors with the right connections made windfalls by importing duty-free more materials than they needed for new hotels and selling the surplus to others. It was rumored that besides the $250,000 to obtain a license, an additional, let's just say, under-the-table cash fee was sometimes requested, shall we say. AKA, people were bribed all the time. And it was opening. It was open. It happened blatantly as you can possibly get. In fact, it's very much sidetrack here. When I was in Uganda, maybe, I don't know, it was almost 8 years now. Dang, that's a long time ago. Seven or eight years now. Anyways, when I was in Uganda a while ago, there were always these random tolls that you would have to pay. So a cop will pull you over and be like, oh, you have to pay the fee or you have to pay the fine. But they wouldn't tell you what the fine was for. It was a bribe, of course, right? Now, that happened pretty openly in Uganda. It happens openly in a lot of places around the world. But it didn't happen anywhere near as openly as it did in Cuba, because it was legally sanctioned in Cuba. Anyways, this basically meant that Cuba became an American mob-funded country. Not only the mob, but American business as a whole. In a manner that antagonized the Cuban people, the U.S. government used its influence to advance the interests and increase the profits of the private American companies which dominated the island's economy. By the late 50s, U.S. financial interest owned 90% of Cuban mines, 80% of its public works like water, electricity, 50% of its railway, 40% of its sugar, and 25% of all the value deposited in its banks. Some $1 billion in the 1950s time, a lot more now, in total. According to historian Luis Perez, author of the book on Becoming Cuban, quote, daily life had developed into a relentless degradation with the complicity of political leaders and public officials who operated at the behest of American interests. End quote. All of this, of course, snowballing into what would become the Great Liberation led by Fidel and his revolutionaries. So, now at this stage, we have pretty much everything set into place. All we have to do is press go and let the revolution commence. The protagonist revolutionaries were set to wage battle against the antagonist Cuban government. So, let me tell you a little story. The date is Wednesday, the 10th of October, 1956. A Mexican citizen, secretly representing Fidel Castro, meets with the Schuylkill Products Company Incorporated, an American-based business. The transaction was the purchase of a yacht for $150,000. Oh no, sorry, $15,000. This yacht had military use in the past. It was armored, or maybe not armored, depends on the sources. And it can carry maybe around 15 to 20 people, depending on the payload it was carrying. The name of the yacht? The Granma. Shortly after, a month later to be exact, 82 brave men and women boarded the yacht meant for no more than a couple dozen at most people. These were the revolutionaries of the 26th July movement. They left from Tupan near Veracruz on the 25th of November, 1956. Around 2 o'clock in the morning. After a series of seemingly insurmountable roadblocks and near tragic instances like seasickness, the lack of food, almost sinking tons of times, the Granma made landfall on the 2nd of December on the Playa Las Colorades in the southeastern part of Cuba. This landing location was no random choice. It was meant to emulate the voyage of Jose Martí, who landed in the same area 61 years prior during the many Cuban wars of independence. Che described it best with this, quote, we reached solid ground, lost, stumbling along like so many shadows or ghosts marching in response to some obscure physic impulse. We had been through 7 days of constant hunger and sickness during the sea crossing, topped by 3 still more terrible days on land, exactly 10 days after our departure from Mexico during the early morning hours of December 5th, following a night-long march interrupted by fainting and frequent wet rest periods, we reached a spot paradoxically known as Alegría de Pío, or Rejoicing of the Palace. End quote. Batista correctly predicted that the landing would take place and his troops were ready. Consequently, the landing party was bombarded by helicopters and airplanes soon after landing. Since the terrain of the coastline provided little cover, the party was an easy target. The survivors continued on foot of Pico Tertino in the Sierra Maestra to carry out a guerrilla war. Now, around the same time, student-led riots and demonstrations became frequent all across Cuba. Batista's ship was sinking and sinking fast. In order to quell the uprising of angry voices, Batista closed the university, and so it began. The survivors of the attack of the Granma landing were wandering through the Chic jungle of southern Cuba, lost but not hopeless. Eventually, they regrouped with the help of campesinos, or peasants, who supported the revolution. Out of the 82 on the Granma, only 22 managed to survive and regroup. While the revolutionaries were setting up camp in the mountains, civic resistance groups were formulating on the cities, putting pressure on the Batista regime. Many middle-class and professional people flocked towards Fidel and his movement, while the Sierra Maestra mountains, the guerrilla forces attacked hundreds of Cuban volunteers and won several battles against the Cuban army. Che was shot in the neck at one point and chest during the fighting, but was not severely injured. After all, Che Guevara was a doctor. This was the opening phase of the War of the Cuban Revolution, which continued with brutal fighting largely in the jungles and rural areas of Cuba for the next 2 years. On the 13th of March 1957, a separate group of revolutionaries comprised of mostly students stormed the presidential palace in Havana, attempting to assassinate Batista and overthrow the government. The attack ended in total failure. The leader of the attack was killed in a shootout at the Havana radio station while spreading the false news of Batista's death. Across Cuba, anti-Batista groups carried out bombings and sabotage. Police responded with mass arrests, torture, and extrajudicial executions. Batista's government often resorted to the brutal methods to keep Cuba's cities under control. In the Sierra Maestra Mountains, Fidel was joined by Frank Sturgis from the Watergate scandal, which I maybe may talk about one day, who knows, who offered to train Fidel's troops in guerrilla warfare. Fidel accepted the offer, but he also had an immediate need for guns and ammunition. So Sturgis became a gunrunner. Sturgis purchased boatloads of weapons and ammunition from CIA weapons expert Samuel Cummings, International Armament Corporation in Alexandria, Virginia. Ironically, CIA pretty much helped Fidel, only to try to kill him hundreds of times later. Anyway, Sturgis opened a training camp in the Sierra Maestra Mountains where he taught Che Guevara and the other 26 July Movement rebels soldiers guerrilla warfare. As Cuba's press was censored, Fidel contracted foreign media to spread his message of warfare and revolution. Now, Fidel quickly became a celebrity after being interviewed by Herbert Matthews, a journalist from the New York Times, and reporters from the CBS and Paris Match as well. The guerrillas increased their ranks of 400 men in February 1958, in comparison to the forces that Batista controlled, which were around 50,000 men in total. The United States supplied Batista with planes, ships, tanks, and the latest technology such as napalm, which he used against the insurgency. However, in March of 1958, the U.S. announced that it will stop selling arms to the Cuban government. Soon after, the U.S. imposed an arms embargo, further weakening the Cuban government's position, although landowners and others who benefited from the Cuban government supported Batista. Now, I'm going to pause there for a quick second and sort of analyze why did America stop funding Batista, who they once so loyally supported? Well, it's simple. The United States wants to maintain control of Latin American countries. And Latin American countries with weak governments are often weak or difficult to control. So the U.S., even though they supported Batista, noticed, okay, Batista's losing his support. But the U.S. also didn't realize that Fidel Castro can really hang on to Cuba and give Cuba a strong social and political foothold. So anyways, America basically thought, hey, let's let Batista get overthrown by this nobody, Fidel Castro, and then we'll just do a quick sneaky invasion and invade Cuba, install another puppet, and everything is calm. Of course, things didn't happen quite that way. Anyways, Fidel's guerrillas increased their attacks on military outposts, forcing the government to withdraw from the Sierra Maestra region, and by spring 1958, the rebels controlled a hospital, schools, a printing press, a slaughterhouse, landmine factory, and cigar-making factory. By 1958, Batista was under increasing pressure as a result of his military failures, coupled with increasing domestic and foreign criticism surrounding his administration's press censorship, torture, and extrajudicial executions. That summer, Batista responded with an all-out attack, Operation Verano, or Operation Summer. Creative name, in which the army airily bombed forested areas and villages suspected of aiding the militants. Now, this is happening around the world today, very similar tactics, where governments like the government of Israel and same with the United States and the government of Russia, I mean, a lot of countries, they bomb schools and small towns where they suspect terrorists or insurgents to be hiding, even though the only people there are kids and the elderly. Mothers and young people, innocent people, are largely in these areas. Anyways, Now, 10,000 soldiers commanded by General Eulogio Cantillo surrounded the Sierra Maestra, driving north to the rebel encampments. Despite their numerical and technological superiority, the army had no experience with guerrilla warfare, and Castro halted their offensive using landmines and ambushes. Many of Batista's soldiers defected to Fidel's rebels, who also benefited from local popular support. By November, Fidel's forces controlled most of Oriente and Las Villas, and divided Cuba into two by closing major roads and rail lines, severely disadvantaging Batista. Now, while all of this was happening, Fidel still never came out as a socialist. Being a socialist was still frowned upon in Cuba, after all the Cold War is going on and Cuba is still very heavily influenced by the United States. And Cuba's moderates were needed by Fidel, and Fidel wanted Cuba's moderates. So Cuba said, you know what, I'm not going to come, or Fidel said, you know what, I'm not going to come out as a socialist until the revolution is won. However, even though this was the case, it was totally obvious to pretty much everyone that Fidel was definitely a radical leftist. On the 31st of December 1958, the Battle of Santa Clara took place. In a scene of great confusion, the city of Santa Clara fell to the combined forces of Che Guevara, Cienfuegos, and a group called the Revolutionary Directorate, or RD. Now, they were rebels led by Rolando Cubela and Juan Abrahantes, and as well as William Alexander Morgan, who was an American fighting alongside the revolutionaries. Everybody was involved. Now, news of these defeats caused Batista to panic, and after this, he fled Cuba to the Dominican Republic. Just hours later, on the 1st of January 1959, Comandante William Alexander Morgan, leading his rebel forces, continued the fighting as Batista departed and had captured the city of Cienfuegos on the 2nd of January. Now, yes, there's a guy named Cienfuegos and a city named Cienfuegos. Luckily, I don't mention them much longer in the rest of the story. Anyways, the Cuban general Eulogio Cantillo entered Havana and proclaimed the Supreme Court Judge Carlos Piedra was the new president and began appointing new members to Batista's old government. So now this new general came in and was like, you know what? No, I'm the guy now. I'm the captain. You're the president, but I'm really the boss. Anyways, Castro, learning of Batista's fleeing in the morning, and immediately started negotiations to take over Santiago de Cuba. On the 2nd of January, the military commander in the city, Colonel Rubido, ordered the soldiers not to fight. And Castro entered and took over the city without a single shot being fired. The forces of Che Guevara and Cienfuegos entered Havana at about the same time. They had met no opposition on the journey from Santa Clara to Havana. Castro himself arrived in Havana on the 8th of January, my sister's birthday, shout out to my sister, after a long victory march. And so it ended, victorious for the people. The capitalist dictator fleeing like a whipped dog, replaced with our bearded communist protagonists. Now, I spent a considerable amount of time debating if I should continue the story of Cuba after 1959, or just stop here for now. And as you can probably guess, I chose the latter option. Now, in order to talk about post-revolutionary Cuba, it's to the point where it should deserve its very own separate podcast solely dedicated to post-revolutionary Cuba. It involves so many aspects of the Cold War, other proxy conflicts happening around the world, the Soviet Union, China, Angola. It involves so many places in the world and so many histories, so many people, including Fidel, including Che, that it would require hours upon hours, days upon months, really, of dedicated research, which I might do. I might take this podcast in that direction, but not right now. So for the sake of simplicity and let's just say keeping things concise or as concise as possible, I will end the story with that. Basically, Fidel marching in Havana on the 8th of January, taking over the city. The general Cantillo, he had no power. He had no popular power. He had very, very, very little popular or very, very little military support, and he was forced to surrender. There was no chance of winning. Now, just to briefly conclude here, what did the Cuban people think about the revolution? Well, many of Cuba's poorer citizens and poorer people in general knew that this new government would be good for Cuba and the Cuban people. They knew that this would bring about a change in Cuba. They knew that Cuba would no longer be basically America's whipping boy. Fidel, as well as the revolutionaries, promised and at the end created a Cuba, which stood up to the most powerful country in the world. Meanwhile, that most powerful country in the world was only less than 100 kilometers off of the coast of Cuba. In fact, many people could even swim that distance. It's been done a ton of times. So, this is why I chose to tell the story today as well as my previous episode. It wasn't my greatest episodes ever. I really enjoyed making them, but there were some mistakes here and there, and that just happens. I'm a human being. What can I do? But, like I said, I actually really enjoyed creating these last two episodes, and I would like to do this more often. Not so much in terms of a documentary style or lecture style as I did, you know, with this, but definitely maybe every couple of months I will talk about something or topic regarding leftist history or leftist movements throughout the 20th and 21st century, and just share the stories of what happened in a way that most people can understand without going into so much detail to the point where it's ridiculous. Like, for example, I had a list of stories here. Like, you know, the first one that came on the top of my head was Nelson Mandela, and, you know, of course, South Africa. You had Lumumba, Patrice Lumumba, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or Zaire, or the Congo, whatever you want to call it. So many names in that damn country. Thomas Sankara, Burkina Faso, of course, Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam. Even Colonel Gaddafi in Libya, again, I seem to be obsessed with that guy for some reason, I don't really know. And like even more controversial figures, you know, like Mao Zedong in China, which actually Mao had a huge impact in the black community in America and the Caribbean. And he was a huge proprietor of Pan-Africanism. So many black people, including people I know myself, are, you know, adamant Maoists. And even myself, I take a lot of Mao's principles in my own political view because of the way he stood up for the poor, racialized working classes. Other people like Kim Il-sung, you know, in North Korea, a bit more controversial, but still a very, very fascinating leftist figure who I believe played a very, very important role in, you know, sort of sticking it to America. Also, Saddam Hussein, which wasn't really a leftist, but again, one of those figures who stuck it to the capitalist so-called democracies of the Western world. And again, there are so many stories like those stories, and so many stories like Cuba, Fidel, and the Revolutionary, all of which I would like to eventually cover. Now, don't hesitate to reach out and give me suggestions, because look, I've already received a few on Instagram and Twitter. Oh, excuse my computer, I don't know if you can hear that, but anyways, a little bloopers here and there. Anyway, what I was saying is, do not hesitate to reach out and give me any suggestions that you may have regarding episode ideas or topics you want me to cover. For now, maybe I'll cover a very deep, in-depth topic every couple of months. And in the meantime, my more regular episodes will be my normal rants about what's going on today and what I think needs to be done. Also, if you want to appear in the podcast, please hit me up. DM me, give me a ping. If I sound like a boomer there, dang. Reach out to me, and I think it'd be great to collaborate. I would love to collaborate with some of you. A lot of you who talk to me online, very, very smart people. I mean, all of you are smart because you listen to me. I'm a smart guy. You listen to me, therefore, you're smart. I'm just kidding. About me being smart, you're smart. Anyways, but you get the point. So hit me up, follow me on social media, you find those in the description of today's episode. I really appreciate your patience with all my bloopers in this episode in the past, and I will continue to appreciate your support and your patience in the future. Also, shout out to all of you because I now have 1,000 listeners on this podcast. So I guess I'm big time now, even though none of you seem to follow me on Instagram, which I don't know why. So follow me on Instagram, @ The Lefty Leftist Podcast on, you'll find it below. The Lefty Leftist on Instagram and Lefty Leftist Pod on Twitter. That's it. I'm so bad. So terrible. Anyways, I'm Nate. your host. You're listening to the Lefty Leftist Podcast. Have a fantastic day and keep the revolution alive.
Tu mano gloriosa y fuerte sobre la historia dispara cuando todo Santa Clara se despierta para verte.
Aquí se queda la clara, la entrañable transparencia de tu querida presencia, comandante Che Guevara. Seguiremos adelante, como junto a ti seguimos, y con Cuba te decimos, hasta siempre, comandante. Aquí se quedará clara la entrañable transparencia de tu querida presencia, comandante.